Hello, and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me to the studio today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And if you have any gardening questions, we'd love to hear them, or comments as well, at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or I did post a question to Facebook earlier this morning at the Utah Public Radio Facebook site, and you can send your questions in that way. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Good. I have no sound this morning, so I can't hear what you're saying.
Well, okay, I'll have to hand you my microphone or my headphone.
I'm hoping my mic works, so my headphones aren't working.
Yeah, you're working great.
If there are no questions coming in, I can't hear them for some reason this morning, so.
Well, I can, so I'll hand you my earphones.
Okay,
if I do.
So
we've got lots of things to discuss today, and part of those have to deal with, I'll just start right out with corn, because that was the first question that somebody gave to me a little bit earlier today.
Well, what do you want to know about corn? It's pretty tasty this year, I think. You know, basically the corn that I've had, we haven't been excessively hot. In some years it gets really, really hot, and that then I think kind of takes away some of the flavor of the corn. So this year, because our temperatures have been a little bit on the more moderate side relative to some of the previous years, the flavor has been exceptionally good. And a lot of that has to do with two things I think that we look at in the corn. One is just the sugar content. And so the warmer it is, and particularly the warmer nights, what happens during the day is the plant makes sugars, and it's storing those in the kernels. But at night, in order for those cells to be maintained, we have to have some type of respiration occurring. And that respiration is a utilization of the sugars that are manufactured during the daytime. And so what we're end up seeing is that the plant this year, I think, you know, was storing some of those sugars a lot better. And as a result of that, you know, I think the flavor has been exceptionally good.
Now, we've talked about this in the past concerning melons, but it really extends to everything else, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, because we're really interested in sugar in a lot of different compounds. We're interested in trying to be able to build up those sugars to the point where the flavor profiles that we expect for whatever vegetable we're growing is going to be there. So in the fall of the year, some of the cool season crops, yeah, the types of sugars that we get are a little bit different, and they respond to a different temperature profile, whereas in the summer, we're really interested in things like melons, getting the types of sugars that ensure a nice sweetness. Maybe that musky background flavor is tied to sometimes some other compounds, but it also can be associated with sugars. And then in sweet corn, of course, depending on what cultivar we're growing and what the potential sugar profile is associated with those cultivars, we can either have a lot of sugar or we can have a more corn-type flavor. That's there. And some people really like that sugary flavor, and some people like that more corn flavor, and that's really varietally associated. And so you need to be thinking about that when you're selecting the corn way back in the spring when you're planting the thing.
Well, I'm thinking that gardening in Cache Valley is a great thing now. I know we have listeners all across the state and actually, you know, around the world, but having the temperatures that we do, usually they're not getting too hot in the summer, but even this summer has been exceptional, like you said, as far as moisture. And I mean, I had another quarter inch last night.
Yeah,
I think
you know, we know that from year to year things are a little bit different and things like that. But a couple other things that we're seeing. So you know, when we're thinking about corn, I mean, ultimately we're thinking about what the flavor profiles are in that ear. But the second thing that we're seeing and what some people are asking questions about is why isn't the ear completely filled? So if you think about it, you know, we have in an ear of corn, we have quite a few rows of corn kernels that are within that. And oddly enough, sometimes we get spots where one of those kernels doesn't fill out. And one needs to remember is that each one of those little silks that come out the tip of the ear has to be fertilized with a pollen grain that comes from the tassel up above the ear. And if that particular silk doesn't get fertilized, or if the pollen grain doesn't grow down that silk all the way to where the silk attaches to the cob, then you don't get a kernel that forms there.
So every single one of those goes to a kernel.
Yes. So each one of those silks has to be fertilized. Now, if one goes and looks at an ear of corn, most ears of corn have even numbers of rows. So if you think about it and you cut the ear in half and you count them around just like you would the clock hands going around, there's an even number, so that's uniform. So it could be 12 rows or it could be 14 or 16, but not an odd number. And then if you look at the number of kernels that are in each one of those rows, on average we may see 40, 50 kernels, so that when we sum it all up, you would expect somewhere between, you know, about 400 and 600 kernels on an ear of corn. Now, if you're missing one or two, that's not a bad thing. You know, okay, it doesn't look quite right. Sometimes you'll miss them in the tip of the ear. That doesn't really bother anybody either. But if you have whole sections of the ear that have no kernels to them, then you have to start asking yourself some questions as to why those kernels didn't get fertilized and therefore didn't grow. And sometimes we see them all on one side of the ear, and oftentimes that will happen if the row is, if it's on the outside rows in your block of corn. And normally we recommend you plant in blocks of rows rather than a single long row, is because the pollen has to come from the tassel, which is up above the ear, and drop down to the silks in order to fertilize them. Now, if you're on the outside and you have a dominant wind direction, you may be blowing pollen away from those silks, and therefore you get incomplete pollination that occurs, and maybe half of the ear might not fill out normally simply because not enough pollen is dropping down onto the silks in order to fertilize them.
So how much pollen? I'm just thinking, if you happen to live at the mouth of a canyon, or if you get nightly winds and it's always blowing, is that going to affect it at all, or is it just during the daytime, if just as long as one grain of pollen gets on one of those silks, you're going to be okay?
That's the beauty of a corn plant. It's so redundant. As we said, if you look at an ear, we have even numbers of rows, and we have a fixed number of kernels that potentially are on that ear, and on average, generally, only one ear kind of matures per plant, unless you have your spacing really wide apart, and then you might get two ears that form, but one of them is usually a better ear than the other one in terms of its size and the fullness that are there and the number of kernels that will form. So if we're thinking about that, it from that perspective, the kernels and the cob have maybe 400 to 600 kernels, but each silk or each tassel, the male part, which is in the top of the plant, produces somewhere between 2 and 3 million pollen grains. So if you think about 2 or 3 million pollen grains having out there floating around, falling down and trying to land on the silk, and you only have to fertilize 400, you got a lot of redundancy in the system. So there's a lot of pollen relative to the number of silks that have to be done. Now, the other nice thing about the plant is if a silk doesn't get pollinated, what we find is that that silk will continue to grow until a pollen grain falls on it. And once a pollen grain falls on it and starts to germinate within the silk, and growing down that silk to fertilize that ovule to produce that kernel, then what we end up seeing is then that silk stops growing. And so, you know, what happens is you have this built-in system that allows to or attempts to ensure that the bulk of those kernels are going to form. Now, if you have a dominant wind direction and you have your corn in a block, your outside row sometimes has more problems because the pollen it has to be moved by wind And if it's blowing away from where you expect it to be, you're going to find that that is going to be part and parcel of why the plant isn't being fertilized. So that's one reason. So, you know, blocks are important.
So let me go back real quick before you move on. So if you're living near a canyon and you get those nightly winds, you don't want your rows to be going north-south. You want them going east-west.
Yeah.
Because as the wind's coming out of the canyon, you want it to blow through the block, not across it.
Yeah. Either way, then you, on the end of the row, you're going to have some potential, you know, maybe a few
but you'll
there.
Have shorter
but
amounts
you'll
there.
Have a shorter yeah. amount. Absolutely. So you have to kind of think about some of those things. Most of the time, you don't need to worry too much about that unless you're in one of those unique type of microclimates. The other thing that you also need to be thinking about a little bit is that you really want all the plants to grow really uniformly. Now, if you drive around, the next time you're in your car, drive around and you see people's corn patches, some of them are beautiful. It's obvious that the people have taken really good care of them. Some of them look terrible. And so they've basically grown corn stalks, and they're not going to get a whole lot of productivity because you see plants that are tall and silking and tasseling. You see other plants that are short and have no silks and no tassels in them yet, and they've been all planted at the same time. Some of them are yellowish, like they got iron chlorosis. Probably more likely it's a nitrogen deficiency. So if you're going to grow corn in your garden, it takes up so much space. You really need to spend the time to take care of it so that the plants are all growing very, very uniformly. They're all being watered uniformly. They're all being fertilized uniformly in order for them to grow uniformly so that when the pollen is shed, it's all shed at the same time so that you have the likelihood of getting the bulk of the kernels on all of the ears, on all of the corn stalks that you have out there filling as they're supposed to be filling.
So
some people have said to me, oh, but then I have corn spread out over a longer period of time. Well, yes, you do, but you also tend to have ears that are very sparse in terms of the number of kernels that are on them, because if you're just going to rely on a single plant with one ear and one tassel to be able to fertilize that, the likelihood of it having lots of misses, that's what we call those empty spots on the ear, misses in it, is just due to the fact that there just wasn't enough pollen around, even though the plant produces a copious amount of pollen relative to the number of kernels that are going to be there.
So unlike like planting peas, you can't just, and then watering, you can't just plant corn close like peas and then just keep watering it. I mean, you've got to plant them further apart. You've got to plant the rows further apart. You've got to add nitrogen two or three times during the season.
Exactly.
So when I'm driving around my neighborhood and I see up on the corner this, the first time that they've gardened, and I've been loving watching them garden this year, and then I saw the corn coming up, and it looks like the stalks are at least an inch apart.
Yeah.
And it's going yellow, and they're going to be really disappointed.
Well, they're going to get nothing out of it. That's what it's going to come down to. Absolutely nothing out of it. So you've spent, you know, about 60 to 80, well, most corn is about 70 days to mature. So you spent 70 days caring for a crop that you get nothing from.
You can feed it to our goats next door, but that's about it.
Yeah, and that's going to be really disappointing to people. And so that's why on seed packets they tell you, oh, this is the recommended plant spacing that you want to have. That's why Extension puts out bulletins on how to grow these crops and emphasizes all of these points that we're discussing. We maybe don't spend at length talking about what the process is there, but what we do is help you get a better a sense of how to grow this crop so that you're going to have a much more likelihood of being successful.
So which would be better then not too close, but to grow it closer together so you only get one ear from each stalk, or should you grow them further apart and get one, maybe one and a half?
Well, you have to also understand that it's a little bit more complex than that. And that's the nice thing about this program is that what we can do is we can talk about the complexities and kind of educate people. So not only do you have to worry about the pollen falling down on the ear, but if you look at the anatomy of the ear and the anatomy of the tassel, which is the male part, the tassel is shedding pollen. The tassel sheds pollen over about a 14-day time period. and the ear emits or grows out silks over about a 10-day to 14-day time period. And those two things have to overlap in order for us to get good fertilization of the kernels, and that helps form the ear. So if you have anything that causes the silks to come out later than the pollen is available to it, remember, the tassel only produces pollen for 14 days. If the first ear comes out on the plant and it produces its pollen before the second ear on the plant starts to emerge silks, there isn't going to be pollen available for it. And so it needs to rely on a different plant possibly to do that. Now, if you're growing everything really uniformly, the best approach is to grow them close enough together to get a well-formed ear and only to produce one ear on the plant. And that's why we always say, well, corn takes a lot of space and you really need to plant multiple plantings, and you also need to plant in blocks that are wide enough and long enough so that you get good fertilization of those silks by the pollen that's produced up above it.
Now, I was getting this great idea. I don't know how great it really is, but I thought, okay, if I grow the same variety but grow them like 7 days apart, then that second ear on the first batch will get pollinated by, hopefully, by the corn from the one that's closer to the next batch.
That's true. That can happen. But then again,
of course, it's further apart.
But then again, it's a question of how far does the pollen move in order for it to be able to do that. And generally, we would say that there have been some studies done on that where they've dyed the pollen and then they would go and watch where it falls. You know, normally pollen doesn't move too many rows away from where it is. So if you had a block of six rows of corn, the sixth row may not get pollen over to where the first row is. And so if you're previous planted block has stuff that needs to happen, it might not move far enough so that you still get somewhat incomplete pollination. While we think we can trick Mother Nature has her own set of rules that she needs to operate by, and the corn plant is fixed by its genetics to do certain things, and therefore the best approach is to plant it at the ideal plant spacing relative to the type of plant that's there, and that information is provided when you buy the seed, and it will say plant these 8 inches apart. Normally rows should be somewhere between maybe 28 and 36 inches apart, and when you do that, then the pollen that's produced is more than adequate to make sure that the kernels get filled on those particular ears. And then it's up to you to water it appropriately, to make sure that it's fertilized well, that we don't have too much weed pressure out there, that we control the insects that are also going to, you know, create some problems for us. And then you shouldn't have hardly any of these issues to deal with, unless we have, you know, maybe excessively cold or excessively hot temperatures, which, you know, creates its own set of problems for growing the crop.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden, and Dan Drost is my guest. He's in studio with us for about another 25 minutes. If you'd like to get in a question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can log into the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and there's a statement there about the program, and you can just send your questions that way as well. So backing up here, I'm thinking, all right, space-wise, corn uses up so much space. So what if I were to plant two rows on the outside, and then have it that 30 inches or so in the middle, and then plant another two rows? Are the leaves going to be too close together to block the pollen from falling?
No, that isn't going to be a problem. And you could probably pack them in a little tighter. But what we often will see is that if the plant has enough space to grow, that's when it's going to produce the largest ear that's there. And so as we start packing more plants together, what we end up seeing is ear size actually decreases. Just like if we pack a lot of cucumbers together, the vine doesn't grow nearly as well, and the number of fruits that are produced per plant is way down. Even though the overall productivity per area might be the same, we're just going to see less production on an individual plant. And so the ear will be slightly smaller, but I've got more ears per area. So actually, in the long run, we get about the same amount of production, the same number of kernels that
are formed. So even though I give it more nitrogen, it still isn't going to produce anymore.
It can't compensate really for it. And it has to do with resource allocation. You know, it's under some stress, it's under some competition, and we think we're watering enough or feeding enough. But the plant still has to harvest light and has to transfer that light into grow substances to grow leaves and grow tassels and ears. And so all of those competing things together will actually reduce the per plant productivity, even though the per unit area productivity might be very similar.
So I'm also thinking about how much is invested in growing corn. And also from the corn's point of view, there's no way that these plants are going to survive on their own in the wild. They're just not. Because, I mean, you look, every single silk goes to a kernel.
Yeah.
I mean, just the mechanics of the plant itself just kind of fascinate me to how much is involved in this plant reproducing itself.
Yeah.
So it couldn't, unless it's the coming from what it was, it's a grass.
Right.
It is. Corn is a grass.
Yeah.
So unless it's back to how it was originally grown in Mother Nature, I mean, humans have pretty much...
Yeah, we probably manipulated a few of these grass grains like wheat and barley and rice and corn, you know, so much relative to what their wild types were like to make it much more easy for ourselves and to try and maximize the productivity. While it's fun to grow corn in your garden, I always advocate that, you know, most gardeners don't have as much space to really do it. And so therefore, if you have your whole backyard in garden, yeah, maybe grow corn. But, you know, it's really pretty cheap when you just go out and buy it. To buy it once a week or twice a week isn't that much money relative to the effort that you have to put in to make sure that it's going to produce what you want. And the corn growers, the sweet corn growers of this state do an excellent job of producing the corn that they do grow. And I just think that you can get more productivity out of other items in your garden than growing corn. And so I tend to say to people, well, you know, yeah, you like to do it, but too often you see such low levels of productivity because you just aren't managing it the way it needs to be managed, and you would be better off to grow, you know, broccoli and radishes and lettuce and green onions and all of those kinds of things, which don't take up a lot of space and just produce a tremendous amount of product.
Well, and when you look at it nutritionally, if you're growing your garden for the nutrition, corn is the worst.
Yeah, yeah.
As far as helping you out that way, because the nutrients that are in it are bound up and your body doesn't even use them. So All you get is some simple carbohydrates and some roughage, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's true.
I mean, it tastes good, but...
And so, you know, I always say that, you know, think of other crops that you can grow and you know, as you learn, start with what you might think is the easiest, but corn isn't always that easy for us to do, so.
Okay, now, you said a word before the program, and I just love this word, pericarp.
Yeah.
So in relation to pericarps, I'm going to talk about this method of shucking your corn that I discovered off the internet, and it actually works.
Okay.
So you take two ears of corn, and you know how it's attached to the plant itself.
Yeah.
And then you can tell kind of where the base of the ear actually starts. Well, you want to cut at least a half an inch of that base off.
Okay.
Ahead of time, and then you take those two ears, put them in the microwave 2 minutes, so a minute each ear, and then pull it out with an oven mitt because they're going to be warm, and then you grasp the top of the ear, squeezing and holding it tight, and then shaking it down in a downward motion, and that ear just slips right out.
No kidding.
It just comes right out. And then cook it from whatever you would do from there. You don't have to worry about shucking it. You don't have to worry about scraping all the little silks off. Uh-huh. It just comes out clean as a baby's bottom. So just stick it in. We like to either grill them or pressure cook them.
Yep.
Corn for just a couple of minutes. And it was, when we did this, it was like no mess, no hassle.
Well,
and
I'll have to give that a try.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. And so, but in relation to that, we were talking before the program about how you've had corn that's microwaved completely cooked.
Yeah.
And you don't care for it as much because of
what happens to the
pericarp.
That's
so explains
right.
the pericarp.
Okay, the pericarp is basically what we would call the seed coat of the kernel. Okay, so that's the outer coating of it, and what I think anyway, when we do microwave corn, it toughens that up, and if you steam it or if you roast it or do one of those things, the changes are different in terms of how that pericarp firms up or hardens up, and so I find that microwave corn anyway, which I get periodically, isn't as palatable to me, sticks into my teeth more, you know, it just is, has a different texture to it. Because, you know, what we want is both a flavor and a texture component. Those are how we associate foods. And if that changes the texture in any way, it may not. And I just find that I just don't like it nearly as much. But I will have to try the microwave thing just to deal with the shucking part, and then cook it the way I like to cook it and see whether I can see a difference. So I'm going to have to do some more corn eating over the next week and see whether I can pick up some differences with that.
But, and we've got this secret method, which is no longer secret. It's on the UPR website. Click on programs and go to Zesty Garden.
Okay.
And you'll see it right there.
Oh, great. That's good.
We're going to take a quick break and then be back in just a bit. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we're looking for your questions or comments. 1-800-826-1495. Go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there, or send it to us via email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in today's gardening calendar, the Logan Library's Lunch and Learn series is featuring a presentation today with Joe Archer. He's director of the Logan Mosquito Abatement Program, and it's from noon to 1 p.m. today in the Jim Bridger Room in the Logan Library. Information is at facebook.com/Logan Library Friends. The Tonicwood Nature Center in St. George is hosting Fall into Vegetable Gardening. It's this Saturday, August 9th, from 10 to 11. One of the benefits of living in southern Utah is the long growing season, so you can learn how to make the climate work for you and your vegetables. All the workshops are free and open to the public. The Tonicwood Nature Center is at 1851 South Dixie Drive. The Utah Onion Association will host Utah Onion Field Day. That's this coming Tuesday, August 12th at 8 a.m. in Ogden, featuring a tour to review onion research and extension efforts in Utah. I'm guessing you have something to do with this, Dan. For more information, contact USU Extension Vegetable Specialist Dan Drost at 797-2258.
It's really geared toward our commercial farmer. So, you know, the average person, if they want to come on it, it might be a little bit beyond their efforts and understanding, but, you know.
But if you like onions.
If you like onions, show up. I don't care.
The Stokes Nature Center is hosting Backyard Harvest Jam Making Saturday, August 16th from 9 to 11. Local jam maker Liz Butcher will lead this hands-on workshop in the incubator kitchen at the Bridgerland West Campus. Participants will be asked to bring fruit and a few empty jars, and will go home with jars of no sugar added jam recipes and ideas. Registration is required. Go to logannature.org.
Well, that one actually sounds good. I like her jams. Her
jams
are great.
Jams.
You know, periodically we buy them, and it's just, the no sugar thing is, to me, is a good one. We've certainly, in the jams we make, my wife really has cut back substantially on the amount, and she says, well, you have to cook them a little longer in order for them to set, but boy, they have a really strong fruit flavor rather than kind of this overpowering sweetness to them. So,
well, we have an email question from Nancy. It says, we fertilize our garden when planting. Do we need to fertilize during the growing season? Well, that's a big question.
Well, yes. The short answer is yes. And more complete answer would be it kind of depends on the plant. So if you're growing radishes, which only mature in about 30 days, you may not need to fertilize those. If you're going to grow tomatoes, by the time the plant starts to produce flowers, you'll see that the plant isn't growing very vigorously, and you may set a lot less tomatoes as a result of being under some nutrient stress. So yes, you do. And most of our extension fact sheets, which are on the USU website, you can just go to usu.edu and then say, I'm interested in tomatoes. And bang, you're going to find all the stuff that's on tomatoes in the extension library, and use that information, and it tells you how to fertilize, when to fertilize, and all that kind of stuff. So yes, you need to be thinking about that, and it relates to corn, it relates to all these crops that grow a long time, that a one shot of fertilizer at the very beginning usually is not enough to sustain the crop throughout the whole growing season. Now, if you're an organic producer who doesn't do side dressing per se, but is trying to build up a reserve within the soil of nutrients and things like that. Most of our organic fertilizers are slow release, and so they're releasing over the course of the whole growing season. At times, you still may need to supplement a little bit because there are peak periods when a little bit of extra fertility can go a long way for making sure that that plant is adequately supported. And so it would be like saying to your son, well, you know, I can feed you one time this week all of the food that I would feed you at breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the whole week. How would you like that? You know, and your son wouldn't like that. I certainly wouldn't like that to say, well, Monday morning, I got to eat all my food for the whole week. You know, so plants in many ways are like us. They need to be fed regularly in order for them to produce the kinds of productivity levels that we are expecting. And so, you know, use that resource that's there from the Extension Service to help you figure that out.
Now, a lot of those nutrients are going to be in the soil, but some plants feed heavier on certain nutrients that the soil just can't give enough of, for instance, like the corn and nitrogen. But going back to something like beans, for instance, I've never fertilized my beans. Am I missing out?
No, but I think if you would dig up your beans, and you should do that, and carefully dig them up and wash the soil off and look to see if there's little bumps and little growths that are on the root system. Interestingly, beans and peas are legumes, and legumes have bacteria that colonize the root system, and the bacteria then uses some of the nutrients and some of the energy that the plant produces for them to function and interact with the plant. But in turn, what they do is they fix atmospheric nitrogen, which is hard to break and hard to get access to, but they then release it to the plant for them to need to use. And then when we incorporate all of that bean residue, there's lots of nitrogen in there, plus those bacteria have lots of nitrogen, and then the next crop that grows after those beans uses some of that as well. And so there's this relationship that's there that's very, very helpful for the garden.
So even though the bacteria are in the soil, they're taking it out of the nitrogen
out of the air, exactly.
Well, let's move on to another thing that we wanted to make sure we talked about before the program ended, off-tasting cukes.
Yeah, we sometimes run into that when we have really high temperatures. There are the broader family of plants for the cucumbers and melons and squashes is the family Cucurbitaceae, and these cucurbits, the shortened word that we use for it, produce some compounds that are bitter. And when we have hot weather, or if we have plants that are under water stress, or if we have plants that are under nutrient stress, or if plants have spider mites or squash bugs or cucumber beetles feeding on them, these plants produce a terpenoid that's called cucurbitacin. And that compound is bitter. And most of it we find in leaves and in stems, but when the fruits are under growing on plants that are stressed, we also find it in the skin of the cucumber or the squash, the zucchini or something like that. And you say, oh, it's got a sharp flavor or it's got a bitter flavor. And it's those terpenes that are being produced as a response to a stress. And so if we can keep our stress levels low, my blood pressure doesn't get too high, but the plants, the way it says, I don't produce as many of these. And so one way to solve that problem is to check and see if you have water stress, nutrient stress, insect pressure, disease pressure, which may cause the plant to produce these. And if you don't have any of those, then another thing you can do, some varieties just produce more of these compounds, and it may be varietal that you say, oh, I grow this one and it doesn't taste bad, but this one does. Well, in the future, you may want to grow the other one, and it may be you as well. So, because people respond to it differently as well. Some people don't notice the bitterness. Other people do because their taste buds are different and their genetics is different. And so there's lots of things that can cause those bitter compounds. I haven't seen a lot of it this year because, once again, we have not been too terribly hot. So plants really aren't under stress. But you can create your own stress by not watering them. You go away for a few days and then you come back and, you know, you didn't get the water on quite the way you wanted it, or you see the plants wilting a little bit. And so try to avoid all of those things, and then you have less of this bitter compound being formed.
Do you know if terpenes are an antioxidant?
I don't think so.
Okay. And the reason I asked that is because I was hearing on the Splendid Table, they were talking about how when you're tearing lettuce leaves, the plant sends antioxidants to that point to help heal itself. So I thought, oh, maybe this is okay. So
no, let me check. But I don't think they are the antioxidants that they were talking about relative to those kinds of things. So
I mean, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's exactly right.
Yeah. 1-800-826-1495 is the toll free number. You can email us at zestygarden@gmail.com or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, is in studio with us today. And we have about eight minutes left in the program. All right, so talking about melon maturity.
Well, we need to talk about this about every year because it's, you know, people grow melons in their gardens. We're picking melons that are out of our research plots right now. In your vegetable garden, how do you decide when a melon is ripe? Well, cantaloupes are easy because what will happen is the cantaloupe will be a bright green color. It'll have some netting, and if you look at the background color behind the net, it's still green, it's still immature. When that background color starts to turn golden, that's when you know it's starting to ripen. And then how do you make the final determination? Well, you look at where the stem and the fruit attach, and if you can grab the stem and you can break the fruit away from that stem cleanly and easily, then that fruit is perfectly ripe. So in your garden, cantaloupes are pretty straightforward. Watermelons are a little bit more tricky because you don't really know. You don't have any good visual clues. You might look at things. People talk about thumping them. I hear the thumping thing, talked about a lot. It's a poor way to determine whether your watermelons are mature. An easier method is for you to roll the melon over and look at where the bottom of the melon was sitting on the soil or on your plastic. It should have a yellowy tone or a creamy colored tone. And if it has those colors, that's a good starting point to determine whether it's ripe or not. If it's whitish colored, it's still immature. The second thing that you want to look for is where the stem attaches to the vine, there's a little tendril. And the tendril is just a modified leaf. It looks kind of like a pig's tail, kind of curlicued. That tendril needs to be completely dry all the way back to where it attaches to the vine. So the fruit is attached to the vine, and then at that same junction is a tendril. And if that tendril is completely dry and the ground spot is yellow or creamy colored, then that fruit is ripe. And you can harvest it, and you should have bright red color in it, and you should have some sugars and all of those types of things in it. Why thumping doesn't work is because if you thump in the morning, the plant overnight hydrates itself from moisture that's in the soil, and it has a different sound to what it would sound like if you were thumping later in the day. So that then brings me, what should you look for when you go to the grocery store? Because you don't have some of these clues, and you see people thumping away in the grocery store, and you know, it just doesn't work.
And truth be told, they're only doing it because they've seen someone else
do
it.
Exactly right. And they don't know what they're listening for. Should it sound dull and hollow? Should it sound ringy? You know, people just don't know. So I don't even talk about thumping. And I won't even tell you what they say because it defeats the purpose. The best thing for you to do, roll the melon around and look for the spot where it was laying on the ground. And if that spot has that nice kind of creamy yellow tone to it, that's going to be a ripe melon.
So not light cream, but it's got to be
More toward the yellows. Yeah. If it looks more toward the white color, it's more immature. Now, luckily, if you're buying local melons, our local melon growers know how to harvest melons so that they're ripe. And you're going to very rarely get a bad one. So that's why
we're like Green River or Utah.
Or you're going to find some that are going to come out of St. George, or there are some melon growers up in the north here that are bringing them into their farm stands or being shipped to some of the local grocery stores. Those guys know what they're doing, so you're going to be pretty safe in just kind of grabbing one and getting and
going.
They're
trying to ship them all over the place.
They don't want to go too far with them, so they pick them really when they're fully ripe, and so that's a good way to do it. And so if you know those two tips for in the garden, you know, tendrils, look at tendrils because those are really good indicators. Background color doesn't always equate with ripeness. So that ground spot in a tendril in the garden, just use the ground spot in the grocery store. And if it's too much of a melon for you, sometimes the local grocery stores cut melons and then you can look at it. And then you're going to be pretty assured that you got yourself a ripe melon that's going to have the sugars, and it's going to have that melon flavor that we're really looking for.
Now, will it help you to look at a cantaloupe in the store to make sure that the stem has pulled completely away, that like part of the stem's not still there?
Yeah.
And then also, can you smell that stem? And if it smells really cantaloupe-y, is that another
signal? Yeah, that's a good indicator. But then there are some of the cantaloupes that have less aroma to them. So smelling doesn't usually work. Some people say, well, you can take the flower end of the melon, and if you put pressure on it and it gives, then it's ripe. But I usually find that if it starts to give, it's actually a little bit overripe. Mm. And so the inner flesh will be a little softer than maybe you want. And that is something that some people don't like.
Well, we just bought a cantaloupe. I don't know where it came from, but it was in a store. But if it must be a Utah cantaloupe, I'm guessing.
Yeah, the Green River guys and the...
It was sure good, and that's because of the temperatures. Yeah. We've had good temperatures this summer.
Yeah, the growers in Green River and St. George who are shipping melons up this way, and they're shipping a lot of melons, are really sending high-quality stuff.
Well, we've just reached the end of our time, and we do have a caller, but we're going to have you take that off the air so we can go on to Petals and Pros. Dan,
okay,
thanks
good.
For coming in.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Up next is Helen Cannon and talking about the secrets to Emily Dickinson's poetry.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros. I wanted to talk today about Emily Dickinson and her gardens. Before I start talking about that, I would like to try to remember a poem that I relate to. I'm doing this from memory, so I may get a few words wrong. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How stupid to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog. If I were to pose a question for you, saying the name Emily Dickinson and asking what you thought of, I would suppose that most of you would first think poet, and then perhaps some of the other things that we know about Dickinson, white dress, cloistered woman, but I doubt that many of you would think gardens and gardening. And yet, in her hometown in Massachusetts, if you said the name Emily Dickinson, I would venture to bet that most of the people there would think gardening. She was known in her township as a wonderful gardener. I was reared in a garden, you know, she's quoted as saying. I'd like to use words from two books about Dickinson's Gardens. The one, Emily Dickinson's Gardens, A Celebration of a Poet and a Gardener by Marta McDowell, and The Gardens of Emily Dickinson by Judith Farr. In thinking about Emily Dickinson as a gardener, beyond being the stuff of legend, she was also a real person devoted to her family with pleasures and pastimes and friends who were important to her. She shared a love of plants with her parents and siblings. To friends, she sent bouquets, and to her numerous correspondents, over 1,000, she often enclosed flowers to punctuate a message. She collected wildflowers, walking with her dog Carlo. She studied botany at Amherst Academy, which, by the way, was started by her grandfather. She grew houseplants and tended a glassed conservatory off her father's study. In winter, she forced hyacinth bulbs. In summer, she knelt on a red blanket in her flower borders, performing horticulture's familiar rituals. Spring in Amherst is euphoric. A visual olfactory high, Emily called spring an inundation. Bright green leaves pick up the wind, mimicking the sound of a stream, makes riffling over rocks. The sun heats up blossoms, drying out their scent. Today is very beautiful, Emily once wrote to her brother Austin. Just as bright, just as blue, just as green and white and crimson as the cherry trees full in bloom, and the half-opening peach blossoms, and the grass just waving, and sky and hill and cloud can make it, if they try. For her first 9 years, Emily encountered spring outside the doors of the old Dickinson homestead. In 1840, however, Emily and her family moved to a house on North Pleasant Street, a few blocks from where she had been born. Emily had new ground to garden. We don't know much about the North Pleasant garden. The only surviving picture shows a comfortable white clapboard house with a large porch that looks out on fruit trees in the front yard. Emily wrote to Austin in spring, "Our trees are all very full of blossoms now, and they look very beautiful. We found that the admission of girls to such lectures as they could understand at the university was a practice of some years' standing, and no evil had been found to result from it." In addition to his lectures, Dr. Hitchcock also preached to Sunday services. "When flowers eventually died, and I was a child," Emily remembered, "I used to read Dr. Hitchcock's book on the flowers of North America. This comforted their absence, assuring me they lived." In addition to Dr. Hitchcock and his books, Amherst Academy introduced Emily to other books on flowers. "The study of plants and flowers, considered a genteel occupation for women. Open the little brown book that Emily opened and read the introduction from Mr. Lincoln. The study of botany seems peculiarly adapted to females. The objects of investigation are beautiful and delicate. Its pursuit, leading to exercise in the open air, is conducive to health and cheerfulness." So women were thought to be especially adept at collecting flowers. Botany was the rage for theological reasons as well. During those decades of evangelical Protestantism in Amherst, studying natural phenomena was considered an avenue to understanding the plan of the deity. A popular saying was, "His pencil grows in every flower." Emily Dickinson was given an herbarium by her father, but not the sort of herbarium that we consider an herbarium now. Years ago, I worked in the herbarium on campus. One of my dear friends and curators of the herbarium calls the herbarium a plant morgue. Emily collected a specimen of each plant, over 400 of them, then pressed and dried them in between sheets of blotting paper. it's likely that she had a plant press to go along with the herbarium. A press is made of two rectangular pieces of wood or an assembled wood lathe with heavy straps to tie it together. Otherwise, she would have dried her plants in the pages of large books. Emily laid out the dried plants, not exactly like a collage, but as a graphic designer might. Each specimen is carefully mounted with strips of gummed paper and neatly labeled in her best penmanship. The layouts are lovely, and Leela Schultz, who is the herbarium person and probably the authority on Western flora, told me that sometimes herbariums, as we know them today, will receive an herbarium of the book sort, and they're very valuable monetarily, not because they are particularly accurate, but because they are a curiosity. On many pages, Emily offset a single large specimen with several smaller ones. Sometimes the arrangements are whimsical. Two daisies crisscrossed at the bottom of a page like swords, supporting a coat of arms. Others are vigorous. Three stems fanned out over a tripartite leaf of hepatica. Later in the album, Emily inserted more specimens per page, as if she worried about running out of room. All the pages in the album, as she continued to collect specimens, she had to fit them in wherever she found space. Next time, I hope to be able to continue thinking about Emily Dickinson and by using the book by Judith Farr on her gardens. Thank you for listening. Tune in again. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.